to swim.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It is books, writing, and literary culture coming to you every week. My name is Andrew Popel, and it is my great pleasure to talk books with you. So thank you. Thank you for joining me. I want to start the show by acknowledging 2SER broadcast from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And I'm also recording this show on the lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people in lovely mountains outside of Sydney. So I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and their ongoing connection to the land. Sovereignty was never ceded. It is always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I want to also, before we get started with the books, send a big thank you out to all of you. All of our incredibly generous listeners, your generosity has helped us raise the $30,000 we need to replace our antenna. Look, if you haven't tuned in recently and heard the message, the 2SER antenna, our broadcast antenna, was struck by lightning. We needed to replace it so that we can keep bringing you independent news, great local arts, and of course books. And your generosity has helped us save our signal. We got there. We had it set for. We wanted to get to saving our signal by the end of June, and you helped us get there by the 23rd. So that is just absolutely unbelievable. Thank you so much, everybody. You can, if you are intending to make a donation, you can still make a tax-deductible donation at 2ser.com. All of your generosity goes towards helping us with the various expenses of being a community radio station. We are community-funded, and you are our community. So, look, I'm going to say thank you again. Thank you so much for your generosity. It lets us do what we do here. Now, today on the show, I'm still taking just a wee break to catch up on my reading, but I have an absolutely fantastic look back going into the archives. We're revisiting some of our favorite Aussie classics book clubs, and we're going back to, I think this one was back in 2017 when we read Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright. Now, around that time, there was also a production, an adaptation being made for television of Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright, and I was absolutely just stoked to be joined by the director of that adaptation, Kriv Stenders. Now, if in the intervening time you have had a chance to check out that that TV adaptation, this is a great opportunity to listen back and get some insight into Kriv's thinking and his artistic process in bringing Kenneth Cook's book to the screen. I'm also joined by my amazing friend in the book club, Texts David Winter. David joins me in so many of the book clubs, and it's always great to chat to him. So today on the book club, Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright, joined by Kriv Stenders and David Winter. My name is Andrew Popel. This is Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture, and Wake in Fright, it's coming up after this short break.
Thank you.
Yay!
Thanks to your generosity, we've raised the $30,000 required to replace our FM antenna. We couldn't have done it without you.
You're goddamn right.
But you can still make a tax-deductible donation at 2SER.com before June 30 to help with the many costs of keeping 2SER on air.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and it is that time of the month again where we revisit an Australian classic, help you discover a piece of Australian writing that may have been lost but is getting a little bit of a resurgence, and no more so than this month's book. We will be discussing Wake in Fright by Kenneth Cook. This book is a classic both on the screen and on the page, and is being rebrought to the screen. It's coming soon to Channel 10, an adaptation, and we are very fortunate to be joined by the director, Kriv Stenders. Kriv is the acclaimed director of such films as Red Dog, Kill Me Three Times, Red Dog, True Blue, and he is directing the adaptation that will be coming soon to Channel 10. As always, of course, I'm joined by David Winter, and David is a senior editor at Text Publishing. He's my regular raconteur in the Aussie Classics Book Club. Kriv, David, welcome. But David, before we get to the story, can you tell us a little bit about Kenneth Cook?
Sure, Andrew. Well, as you were saying before, I think many people know of Wake in Fright from the 1971 film, which was made by the Canadian director Ted Kotcheff. which is an absolute cult classic in Australian cinema. But I think this is a really rare case where the novel and the film are considered equally brilliant. It was the novel was actually published a decade before the film in 1961. It was Kenneth Cook's second book, but in a way it was his first because the first book had been pulped. It was deemed to be libelous. So he was kind of a scandalous author from the start. He was born in Western Sydney in 1929. He was born in the suburb of Lakemba, which was the same place that David Ireland, who won the Miles Franklin multiple times, was born a couple of years earlier. Cook decided to be a journalist. He joined the ABC in his early 20s, and he was posted to Broken Hill out west, and that's the town fictionalised as the Yabba in Wake and Fright. Wake and Fright was published when Cook was in his early 30s. He went on through his fairly short life to write more than 15 novels across a range of genres and subjects, but I think it's fair to say that Wake and Fright remains both his best and his best known. It's one of his most literary novels. Despite its brutality, it's very subtly crafted, I think. Cook also wrote for the stage and for the screen. He died, I think he was about 57. It was in the late 1980s. And in his last years, he had tended towards genre writing. His 1980 novel, Pig, is about a killer pig. I haven't actually read it, but it does sound pretty wild.
It's agreed that this book is a classic in every sense of the word. I want to go probably first to impressions when one enters, well, not even the Yabba, but to Boonda, which is where John Grant is teaching. Cook's writing is incredibly visual. I can't wait to hear what you have to say about this, Kriv, because you are realizing, of course, Cook's writing in a visual medium. But it really, really struck me how visual this is and how visceral the heat, the oppressive just nature of the Australian environment. What were your impressions just entering the book? Kriv, can I start with you?
Yeah, well, look, I've got to basically qualify all of this by saying I saw the film first. I hadn't read the book. I'd only read the book when we began to think of adapting it into a series. So my discovery of the book came very late in the process. And I first saw Wake and Fright back in the 80s on a very dog-eared VHS that was being swapped around by amongst some friends, because up until that point, up until the re-release, it was almost virtually impossible to find the film. But even back then, you know, in the 80s, as a teenager and a young budding film student, this was a film that, you know, was as you said before, was a cult classic already way into the 80s. So my entry into the book was via the film. And then when I read the book, I was struck by how closely the film followed the book, because the book is actually written very much in a very lean, muscular screenwriting style. And as you said, it's very visual. And there's and Kenneth Cook writes in this beautiful, very direct shorthand that is as a visualist, as a filmmaker, I immediately respond to, because you, as you said, it's suddenly, you know, you can see the imagery, you can feel and taste the world that Cook's talking about. So I must admit, I'm probably a little bit biased because I'm watching, I read the book through the prism of the film and through the prism of our own adaptation of what we were going to try and do with it. But, you know, our whole way forward with entering back into this material was to go back to the source book. And even though the film follows the book very closely, there's also a lot that's not in the film. And that's what we found very interesting and intriguing.
David, what were your impressions, though, as soon as you entered Toowoomba and then the Yabba?
Oh, look, it's just the intensity and oppressiveness of the heat, I think, and the sort of sparseness of everything. But we've got to keep in mind too that we're getting it all in, it's in third person narration, but we're getting John Grant's view. And although he is our hero and we care about him to some extent, he's also a snob, and everything that he says about Toowoomba and the Yabba is laced with big city condescension, and that's what I really noticed on the second read. I think the first read for me, this when I read this book maybe about 10 years ago, was just how sort of fierce and savage and horrible it is. And then on this read, I thought, yeah, I kind of see how John Grant is not a particularly good guy, and he kind of brings his undoing upon himself. And right from the first page, he's really snobby about being in this remote place, even though in some ways, I don't know whether you've been out to Broken Hill, but it's really quite beautiful, the sparseness, in an odd kind of way. But his reaction, John Grant's reaction, is just revulsion, because he wants the coast and he wants the big city and he wants the suaveness of people in the big city. And all the people in Toowoomba, well, there doesn't really seem to be anyone in Toowoomba, but the people in the Yabba are so smug about the town, and they love it so much, and he thinks they're just, deluded.
On John Grant's snobbery, this might actually sound really strange, but the voice in the first few pages, and then when we get to the Yabba, I was actually reminded, I was struck immediately by a sketch by Irish comedian Dylan Moran, where he describes Australia as located 3/4 of a mile from the surface of the sun, with people audibly crackling on the streets. It's it's not supposed to be inhabited. And this plays for comedy when Moran does it. And we're struck by how insular Dylan Moran seems. And he begins the joke by claiming that he rarely leaves the house. And I sort of thought, is John Grant serious? I couldn't quite believe that everything was as bad as he made it sound. But, Kriv, it strikes me that this scene can be realised really differently with a visual medium. And how do you feel about the way we're introduced to the Yabba in words, as opposed to that sort of visual that you bring to the story?
Well, I think you're right. I think what you guys are talking about in terms of the character of John Grant and his disdain or his judgment of the world and the people around him is something that, again, even as a visual storyteller, that's you're also telling a story. Mm-hmm. So, that immediately creates a very intriguing character, someone who is at odds with this world that they're in, and can be thrust into yet even more conflict and more confrontation as the story develops. So it's great material. It's just great drama. It's a great setup or a great conceit. And it's interesting because we heard a few stories about Kenneth Cook from his children who we were dealing with the rights, and from what we understood, that Cook himself absolutely hated Broken Hill, and was very much, I think John Grant is very much a cipher for Kenneth Cook, that I think you got to realize, when he wrote the book, would have been in the late 50s. I think the Broken Hill of the late 50s is radically different to the Broken Hill of today.
It's interesting to think of John Grant as a cipher, though, because he's, as David, you've already pointed out, he's not a flattering character. He's described as a coastal Australian. And I got the impression that Cook was toying with the idea that Grant's, in fact, small-minded.
Yeah.
And so much of what happens in the book, Grant brings on himself.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's something else that we, as we started to investigate the story, investigate the book, everything that happens to John Grant is a result of a series of bad choices on his part.
There's actually a line about 2/3 of the way through. He says it was as though he had deliberately set about destroying himself. I mean, that's the dawning realization that, in fact, at every point he could have chosen differently. And as awful as a lot of the people are that he meets, and as much as they muck him around, and some pretty awful stuff happens to him, he is the architect of that. There is no one person who is out to get him. He's so obsessed with the idea that the place as a whole is going to subsume him, and he has to escape it. He doesn't realize that he's actually given into it.
You are tuned in to the Aussie Classics Book Club here on Final Draft. It is 2SER 107.3. Thank you so much for joining me and celebrating books here in, we're broadcasting from Sydney, but you can listen to us online, you can listen to us on the podcast, and celebrate books across Australia and across the world. Today we are enjoying Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright, and this is a listen back to a conversation that I had a few years ago, and I'm joined by the director of the recent adaptation, Kriv Stenders, as well as Text Publishing's David Winter. We're getting into the cultural snobbery and the horror that is so present in Wake in Fright, part of what makes it a bit of a classic examination of the Australian psyche. Now, we've got more of that conversation coming up, but I did want to share a track. Got some new music from Melbourne's Thibault. And look, this is a really poignant track for so many reasons. The track's called Centrelink, and I think that it really kind of sums up what so many artists are going through right now, kind of trying to stay alive and keep themselves going during the coronavirus pandemic. And it is so important to support local arts and artists. Now, just this week, the government has announced a $250 million relief package. And while this may assist some productions, it may assist some festivals to keep going, it provides investment opportunities for the arts, it is still vitally important that we, as arts consumers, who I'm talking to here, if you enjoy listening to music, if you enjoy watching TV, reading books, reading articles, looking at beautiful visual things, you are an arts consumer. We need to directly support the artists that we love. That means buying their work. If that's a book, a digital download, a print, get onto your fave artists and support them directly where you can. So if you love it, get onto their Bandcamp, buy a digital download from Thibault. This is their new track, Centrelink.
Trying not to tear apart my local Centrelink. Things come flowing anyway, no matter what I think. We've all been there, some may not, some may never will. Something dies inside of you.
Tuned into 2SER 107.3. And this is Final Draft. Right there, we heard a track from Melbourne band Thibault, and that was Centrelink. If you loved it, check them out online, check out their Bandcamp, and support local artists. Today on the show, we are looking back into the Aussie Classics Book Club. We are celebrating Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright. And on this interview, I am joined by Kriv Stenders and David Winter.
I found the book really confusing in the beginning because its reputation had preceded it, and I'd heard this word horror talked about. But reading the book and meeting the characters, particularly Jock Crawford, I was struck by this is a reasonably friendly Australian town. I can imagine people that I know reading Wake in Fright and thinking this is actually just someone writing about their really raucous Bucks weekend. And it's really, again, I feel that Grant brings about his own downfall. And it's not until we start to meet Hines and then Dick and Joe and finally probably ultimately realized in Doc Tyden that we start to see the sinister glory of the Yabba.
No, it's very much he does. It's a slow burn, which is what's beautiful about the book and the film, and the original film, is that, you know, you slowly, this character slowly gets immersed into this nightmare, kind of his own making, really, through the choices that he makes. But the overall, I mean, getting to the real crux of the whole book, what I find fascinating about the story and about where John begins and where he ends is that it's a very powerful story about transformation and about adaptation. And in a way, it is a kind of an allegory for Australia and for Australians, and how we either learn to adapt or die.
Yeah, in that sense, it's very much a psychological horror film rather than a book rather and film than a conventional genre horror.
If it is a horror in any form, one of the villains, perhaps stalking in the background, would be the drink, alcohol, beer. You can't escape a drink in Wake in Fright. And I think I actually found in one of my searches into the depths of YouTube that people have made compilations of every drink taken in the original film.
Yeah, whatever you do, do not play the Wake and Fright drinking game.
Yeah.
You'll end up in hospital. And I've tried.
Oh, dear.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was getting ready for this, I just was mucking around and I just typed alcohol in Australia in, and I found the National Health and Medical Research Council, and on their webpage, the first line is, alcohol has a complex role in Australian society. And I felt like this could be a scene note from many of the moments set in and around bars in Wake in Fright. It's beer's this proxy and this crutch for so much of the social interaction.
It is. And, there's a point where Grant says, after a while of being in the Yabba, he realises that you can pretty much do or say anything to anyone there except refuse a drink. If you refuse a drink, then it is just... it is the ultimate social faux pas.
I was so struck by that. I've written it down. He says, you immediately become a mortal enemy. It's quite interesting. Kriv, this was what I got really thinking about your role in interpreting the book, in adapting the book, because obviously in 2017, our culture looks very different to when in 1961 this book was released. How do you approach depicting something like that drinking culture? Is it a strict adaptation, or are you in any way nodding to sensibilities now?
Well, that was what was fascinating and so exciting and intriguing about adapting the book. And what we've done, we're contemporizing the novel and we're retelling the story, and we've kind of invented a new story on top. We've basically used the characters and the situations and the conceit of the story of the book, and we've sort of extrapolated on top of that. But this is one of the core things that we were really interested in exploring, was how much have things changed since Cook wrote the book in 61 and how little have they changed. And we made some very interesting discoveries through that process of mirroring the two periods. And one is that whilst perhaps things have changed socially, you know, the drinking is perhaps not as prevalent as it was back in that time, what still exists is a binge culture. And I think it's interesting now, I think drinking now is and alcoholism is much more insidious. It's much more subtle. And it's much more part of the grain of society. While back then it was either you drank or you didn't. Now it's much more blurred, and I think in a way just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, because there are so many social mores and so many now just accepted social practices involved with drinking. But the underbelly of that is that the alcoholism is a really big problem, but it's just not as perhaps as obvious, or as on the surface as perhaps as it was back then. And the other element that we're looking at as well in our contemporary telling is not only alcoholism, but drug use, and especially in these kinds of mining towns that go bust after booms. You know, that they leave a terrible wake in their path, and health and mental health and drug issues are rampant in these kinds of towns. Statistically, you know, crystal meth production, these are the sort of hubs or kind of starting points for a lot of the crystal meth manufacture. And our story kind of looks into that, adds that to it. So we were actually layering on just not only alcoholism but drug use as well, which has been, you know, an increasing problem or issue since 61.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, Kruv, and I'm actually fascinated to see how you guys deal with it, because mental health, it seems like it's at the forefront of the narrative, despite it being so rarely a topic of overt discussion. The residents of the Yabba, they all seem to demonstrate this kind of stoic beatitude around their own mental health that's undercut by the high rates of suicide that were introduced to by Jock Crawford right at the very beginning when he first meets John. And they talk about how they're frequently covered up as accidental deaths because so many suicides, as Jock says, give the place a bad name. And by the end, John's just completely dissociated, and he has his own trauma that is very much the end of the book. That we might save spoilers for people who really want to discover this for themselves. But the discussion is so very interesting and so very different to what I'm used to in our contemporary culture.
Yeah, well, this is what I think. Cook's book is still so prescient and so alive and so brave. I think it's such a brave, bold piece of writing, because he really, at the very core of this story, is a story about a man losing his mind or losing his soul. And you've got to realize, you know, this is based on fact. And even when we were in Broken Hill shooting, you know, I heard an incredible statistic. Like, apparently even in the mid-90s, Broken Hill had the highest suicide rate in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the world. And it was a direct result of the economy there. You know, these people would set up their lives, set up their families. These men would suddenly there'd be a bust and lives would be shattered, and there would be these shells of men left, trying to cope with the fallout. And that is something, again, that our adaptation definitely examines and explores quite openly. And again, you know, like alcoholism, these are issues, and mental health and suicide, these are issues that are affecting us at this very moment. So that's what's wonderful about diving back into the book and, again, doing this comparison and contrast between now and then. A lot's changed, but then again, very little has.
If you are listening, we are discussing Wake in Fright by Kenneth Cook, and I think we have teased enough that you will be wanting to run out to a bookstore. I've been speaking with Kruv Stenders. He is the director of the Channel 10 adaptation of Wake in Fright, and David Winter. He is a senior editor at Text Publishing. It has been the Australian Classics Book Club on Final Draft. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Andrew. Time for a beer.
Indeed.
You're mad, you bastard.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
This is 2SER 107.3, and my name is Andrew Popel. Now, this is Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. It's almost the end of the show. Look, thank you so much for joining me. Today, we dipped back into the archive and we looked at another one from the Australian Classics Book Club, this time going back to 2017, when I was joined by Kruv Stenders, who Kruv is a director and a filmmaker, and he was the director of the adaptation of Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright. Now, Wake in Fright, of course, was the book that we were discussing today. I was also joined by David Winter, who is a senior editor at Text Publishing. And so, look, thank you to David and to Kruv across the years.
I haven't been in touch with David for a while because of coronavirus, but I'm very much looking forward to bringing back the Australian Classics Book Club at some point in the future. If you missed anything, if you want to listen back and catch up on some other great interviews from Final Draft, you can go to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Thank you also to all of the generous listeners out there who have donated. Save Our Signal has been a success. We have raised the money required to replace our lightning-struck antenna. So thank you to all of you. You can still make a tax-deductible donation at 2SER.com, which helps us pay for all of the things that go into making community radio. My name is Andrew Popel. I have got a stack of great new books coming up. New books from Solari Gentile, Kate Grenville, Robbie Arnott. I am so excited. I'm just trying to think of all the titles I've been reading. But look, I've got to go. I'm bringing them up next week. My name is Andrew Popel. Until then, well, happy reading. Bye now.